case is United States v. Turner. Appellant ready to argue?
We are.
Government?
Yes, sir.
Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, and may it please the court, my name is Captain Zachary Gray, and together with Captain James Barrett, we represent the appellant, Specialist Malcolm Turner. The military judge erred when he denied a motion to dismiss for failure to state an offense that otherwise should have been granted. And as this court stated in United States v. Fossler, the remedy for an erroneously denied motion to dismiss is dismissal. The prosecution charged appellant with an attempt to kill by premeditation, and in doing so, failed to expressly state or necessarily imply every element of that offense, namely that the killing was done unlawfully. After all, unlawful, together with premeditated, together with actually the separate words, without excuse and without justification, are all statutory elements that have been prescribed by Congress, and if the government fails to necessarily imply each of those elements, the specification is deficient.
Counsel, may I ask a question?
Yes, Judge Max.
If the charge sheet had mentioned the word murder, would that be sufficient?
Yes, Your Honor. In our position, particularly because this was an inchoate offense, that by charging the word murder, that would put this in a much more similar posture to this case, this court's jurisprudence in Norwood, where they said he attempted to commit adultery or conspired to obstruct justice. Similarly, if they had said the defendant attempted to kill with premeditation in violation of Article 118, our position is that this would be a much harder case for this court, but now, they did neither.
Please finish your sentence.
Oh, that's all, Justin.
In Norwood, they didn't mention all of the elements. For example, they didn't mention anything about the terminal element. I'm not really sure how you attempt the terminal element anyway. So is the real distinguishing factor for this case in Norwood simply that Norwood mentioned, identified the offense by name?
Yes, Your Honor, but that stems from the underlying principle. When you are pleading attempt, for example, the first element is an overt act to commit, an overt act done with the specific intent to commit an offense under the code. So, for example, when they pled that he attempted to commit adultery, they identified an offense under the code. Under 134, one of the offenses is indeed called adultery. The same with obstruction of justice. There is no offense under the code that is called kill, or killing, rather. It's murder, and that's a meaningful distinction in our eyes, and we believe is as much, if not a substantially more meaningful distinction than the ones that this court drew when it decided its line of LIO cases, ranging from Jones, Girard, Medina, to then when it transferred that same logic to its failure to state a claim. Just like this court returned to a strict black letter reading of the term necessarily included under Article 79, this court in Fossler recognized that it was essentially the same issues at stake and it was the same question, but rather than ask whether something was necessarily included, the question was whether or not it was necessarily implied. And Fossler made it very, very clear that when the objection is raised at trial, that the appropriate test is to look purely to the pleadings themselves. The court doesn't look beyond to the proof of case, to whether the defense was misled, to whether the appellant had some form of notice, or anything akin to that. It looked purely to the four corners of the specification itself. And that makes sense.
Counsel, on this particular point, does it matter that although the objection was raised at trial, it was raised at trial after the findings were already made?
Your Honor, it doesn't matter, and in fact, both parties do not contest that it was raised in full compliance with RCM 907B1B or even B2E, the amended version, Your Honor.
And if we were to dismiss this charge, I mean, it would be a new case, but could the government re-prefer charges and charge with attempted murder with a properly stated charge such that there'd be no double jeopardy?
Your Honor, our position here is that Specialist Turner has never been charged with attempted murder, and presumably they would have to make a some sort of issue preclusion, Ash v. Swenson style. It would be it would certainly be a more interesting double jeopardy argument, but our position today is for many of the same reasons, well, actually for exactly the reasons that we win today, it would make it at least a more difficult case when it came to defending against or to putting forth a double jeopardy protection motion on the trial.
Captain Gray, doesn't an accused waive his double jeopardy claims and protections by appealing, especially this kind of appeal on this kind of an issue? When he's actually appealing, isn't there always the chance that he could have a new trial? So isn't he always waiving his double jeopardy claim?
It depends on the grounds asserted under the appeal.
Why wouldn't it be the case here? He's complaining about the failure to state the offense he's now been convicted of, right? If he wins,
yes, Your Honor.
You've just admitted that the government could retry him.
We believe that it...
I'm not sure what double jeopardy claim would be left at that point.
Your Honor, my only thought would be under the unique facts and circumstances of this case, where he's also been charged with charged and convicted, and the conviction stands with conspiracy to commit murder. We think that there's a potential argument out there that that entails all of the elements of attempted murder. I don't want to lock my fellow colleagues at trial down the road should there be a subsequent rehearing into any particular position. I'm not trying to be dodgy, Your Honor.
I understand.
I just don't want to be quoted on the record down the road.
I assure you, you're going to be quoted nonetheless, but as I understand, we're being recorded right now, aren't we?
So I want to turn back, though, to...
Can I, before you do, Captain Gray,
of course,
can I flesh something out that I think is important here? You were noting that there's a difference between an objection made during trial and after trial. That during trial, you hew closely to the plain language. Afterwards, we've got maximum liberality. We look at the entire record in the context of that record. Now, in our opinions, we don't refer to after court-martial, and we all know the precise meaning of a court-martial. Instead, the wording is after trial. If we look back at Watkins and Sell and White, the distinction that is drawn there is before trial is before findings. And this objection occurred afterwards. Let me just quote you the language. In Watkins, we said, a flawed specification first challenged after trial, however, is viewed with greater tolerance than one which was attacked before findings. Same with Sell, same with White, same with the Sixth Circuit that was cited in that case, talking about after conviction. So why wasn't this actually made after trial and therefore maximum liberality applied?
Your Honor, 2 points to that. To the best of my recollection, Watkins, and I can't speak to Sell, admittedly, but Watkins also contains language that says, we view it with maximum liberality when raised for the first time on appeal. So I think that this court can find language going to both, so saying both that we view it more liberally after trial, but also perhaps also that it's viewed with more liberality when raised for the first time on appeal. But
you're correct. There are cases that refer to here on appeal, but it's not in those cases. And you can push back on this notion. It's not in those cases where we are saying there's a distinction between court-martial and appeal. We're saying we've always used the term trial, and if you look at the dictionary definition, it has to do with a finding of guilt or innocence. And what we're saying in those other cases we're referring to on appeal, it's in the context of here on appeal, we're going to apply this, rather than trying to definitively state the temporal distinction between before trial and after trial. And doesn't this lead to gamesmanship that might have been engaged in here by trial defense counsel? We're waiting to find out whether we get a result that we can live with, And wouldn't this distinction between four findings get rid of that opportunity for gamesmanship on the part of trial defense?
2 points, Your Honor. The first being that irrespective of the specific definition of trial, I think that the rule under RCM 907B, what was B1B and then was amended to B2E, states in a very, very clear way that a defective specification shall be dismissed if raised before adjournment. That was the amended version. And the president could easily, if gamesmanship is a concern, the president can do exactly what he did after this court decided Humphreys. If you'll recall, the court decided Fossler, and then it decided Humphreys. And in Humphreys, it said at the time, the rule stated that a failure to state an offense can be raised at any point during the proceedings. It was modeled on an old version of the federal rule, Crim Pro 12B.
So why was the military judge wrong here? I mean, this whole thing was argued, right? And the defense made, and excuse me for characterizing this, the rather specious argument, like that they were not on notice that this specification was charging them with attempted murder, right? Attempted premeditated murder. And the military judge went with some care through all the reasons why that was just not true, right? And so given the fact that this is an inchoate offense, and given the fact that there is no such thing as lawful premeditated murder that doesn't have a defense, right? Killing is presumed to be unlawful unless you have a defense, right? So where does that leave you?
But, Your Honor, this court
has... I mean, the argument was made at trial, like, oh, well, this would not rule out, you know, killing someone on the battlefield, but of course it would, because then it wouldn't be unlawful, right? It wouldn't be a killing, right? It would be a defense, which is, no, it was lawful, it was self-defense. I wasn't doing my job.
Well, right?
That wasn't attempted to kill with premeditation by means of shooting her with a loaded firearm.
So people attempt to kill Judge Ryan all the time, and it's not necessarily unlawful. We readily concede.
But killing, attempting to kill with premeditation, right, if there isn't a defense, is by necessity unlawful.
Well, part of what ends up happening, when you take out, again, the statutorily prescribed element, is that the burden is...
The statutorily prescribed element is that they did an overt act that's not lawful.
But... as with the specific intent to commit an offense under the code. And again, that's why I understand. Go ahead, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I understand that the government's point that we focused a lot on the elements of Article 118 versus the elements of Article 80. But that was our point, is that Article 80 itself requires that offense under the code. And therefore, you have to look, because what the government in its charge sheet, not my colleague over there, but the prosecutor at the time, essentially tried to do is charge an inchoate offense, but rather than incorporating the target offense, tried to list all the elements of the target offense, and they missed. They missed the one critical element that Congress has decided to distinguish. And I think it's worth pointing out, too, that if you read the language of Article 118, it not just says unlawfully, it actually separately says without excuse or justification. So that would be the way that it's currently pled usually, which is to say they attempted to unlawfully kill or murder. Under both cases, you necessarily imply that it be done without excuse or justification. So that's a perfect example of a necessary.
And what was his excuse or justification? That he really didn't want to pay child support?
Your Honor, that's the distinction between an objection raised for the first time before adjournment and before for the first time on appeal, is that the court doesn't look to the subjective facts. And that's precisely, I mean, just like this court did in Fossler. And I see my time's running out, but I want to emphasize, I think this makes a very clean rule, because if you look to actual notice as far as the harmlessness analysis and apply it to timely raised objections, it's always going to be self-defeating, because by virtue of defense counsel saying objection, I note that this doesn't state murder, the judge can say, well, you noted it, clearly you have actual notice, no harm, no foul.
Yeah, but in this case, right, the military judge marched through all the reasons why, in fact, he did have actual notice and how he absolutely had everything he needed to defend against and to keep to protect himself from double jeopardy.
Your Honor,
for the same action. So why isn't that enough?
Your Honor, as you stated in both Jones and Girard, actual notice is not in and of itself the end game. That there's an independent Fifth Amendment right not to be convicted of a crime with which you're not charged. And when you raise...
But the notice thing goes into whether in an inchoate offense, whether it sufficiently alleged it that he was on notice.
You're right, but it, but as...
I mean, I know I'm right. No offense. Sorry.
I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Chief.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Captain Tristan DeVega, and I, along with Major Hannah Coffin, represent the government in this case. This court should affirm the service court's judgment because there is no error with the present specification. First, the specification alleged every element of Article 80. Second, the specification mirrored the model specification of Article 80. And finally, the specification provided the appellant with fair notice of the allegation against him and protects him against double jeopardy. Turning to my first point, the specification stated an offense because it alleged every element of an offense under Article 80. As a preliminary matter, this court in U.S. v. Norwood and U.S. v. Bryant has held that in charging an inchoate offense, the government need only allege the elements of the attempt or the inchoate offense, not the elements of the predicate offense, in order for the offense to, sorry, in order for the specification to state an offense.
Counsel, but one of the elements under Article 180, under 80 is that it's an attempt to commit an offense under the code, and in Norwood, the offenses under the code were named, adultery and conspiracy, I believe it was in that, that case. Here, that wasn't named, and in all my experience of practice, in looking at charges, the specification under Article 80 usually names the offense. Do you have any case in which we have upheld an attempt specification that did not name the offense?
Your Honor, I'm currently unaware of any case that says so, but additionally, Your Honor, the specification itself, instead of alleging specifically to the target predicate offense, as in Article 118 Alpha 1, it incorporates by reference the language from Article 18 1 Alpha 1.
Some of the language, but not the crucial unlawfully killed. Just kills.
Well, Your Honor, by incorporating the language from 118 Alpha 1, it includes the unlawfulness of that conduct. So therefore, I believe at that point that there's sufficient notice there, Your Honor.
I asked on a separate question, what is the government's position as to whether this was raised at trial, given that it was raised after the findings? I mean, it seems like a crucial question here, because as I understand the appellant's position, that if they raise it before adjournment, then no facts can be considered, only the language of the specification, and therefore we can't figure out whether they had notice or not. And so it seems crucial that the focus is on whether it was raised at trial or not. What is the government's position on that?
Well, Your Honor, the government's position is that in either case, if this court should believe that this was raised after trial or after the adjournment, or prior to the adjournment, the specification is still sufficient. If we take a look at the fact, or if we view this as it was being raised before the end of trial.
Let's assume that we conclude that the specification isn't sufficient, but that the defendant would have noticed based on all sorts of outside facts. Can we look at those outside facts or not? Their position is no, you can only look at the language of the specification. So the fact that they argued during voir dire that it was attempted murder, that it, the Article 32 was attempted murder, that in discussing instructions and everything, everybody understood it was attempted murder. I believe the appellant's position is we can't consider any of that because if you timely raise the objection to the charge, you can only look at the language of the charge. And so my question is, are they correct on the timing that it was timely raised at trial, even though it was raised after findings?
Your Honor, I think that the appellant is incorrect in that it was timely raised. I think really here what we're looking at is it was raised after the appellant had full benefit, as you mentioned, Your Honor, of seeing the entire trial play out and then being able to strategically lob that objection once they were dissatisfied with the result. At that point, there was no way that the judge could have done anything further to fix that alleged error other than dismissing right at that point, Your Honor, which would not have been appropriate since all the evidence was put out and the appellant had full notice of what he was charged with. But regardless, Your Honor, if the court takes a look at it in another sense and says that this was timely raised and that this was that it's most appropriate to analyze this under Foster and the narrowly hewed close reading, the specification is still sufficient.
I mean, they use the language in Wong Tai that in an inchoate offense that the language has to be sufficient to identify the offense. Can you speak to that issue with regard to this particular specification and the offense under the code of murder?
Yes, Your Honor. As I mentioned earlier, the specification incorporates by reference the first clause of Article 118, specifically premeditated murder. As evident by the appellant's actions at trial, he was fully aware of what he was being charged with. And under this court's precedence, under U.S. v. Bryant and U.S. v. Norwood, the government has sufficiently alleged everything it needed to in order for the appellant to be able to have fair notice and to defend himself to protect against double jeopardy.
So I just want to make sure I understand your argument here. Let me pose a hypothetical to you. There are two soldiers, Fort Hood, bad blood. One says to the other, I'm going to come track you down at your off-post apartment and going to do violence to you. The other person, the other soldier says, if you do that, I'm going to shoot you and kill you. Soldier goes to the apartment and, in fact, under the stand your ground law, shoots him. So one soldier has killed another soldier, but that was lawful. So how do we distinguish that with the language here in terms of failure to state an offense?
Well, Your Honor, I think this, the hypothetical you posed, there is a self-defense thing available there. However, this is a completely different fact pattern here in that the appellant, not having spoken to the...
Okay, but if we're hewing, and I'm using the language from our cases, if we hew closely to the plain text rather than view it, again, I'm using language that we've used, maximum liberality and talking about looking at the broad context of the record. If we're just looking at the language, how do we say that killing is sufficient in terms of identifying the offense when I've just posed to you a scenario where killing, premeditated attempted killing, is not an offense?
Well, Your Honor, in that first hypothetical, I don't believe that, but the person who defended himself in that situation engaged in a premeditated killing. He was simply defending himself. In this situation, we don't have that. In this situation, the appellant, although he forwarded a self-defense strategy, was not defending himself here. And additionally, Your Honor, again, incorporating the language from Article 118, Alpha 1 gives us that unlawfulness. The appellant has the ability to raise a lawful justification if it's available to him, but that doesn't negate the unlawfulness of his conduct here through the specification.
I'm concerned where this argument might lead. Suppose the charge was attempted larceny, but you didn't mention larceny. You just said in that the accused attempted to take property of another, et cetera, without saying unlawfully take. Wrongfully take. Would that be enough if we had larceny and the only thing it said was attempted to take in that he went to the barracks and took something?
Your Honor, if that hypothetical specification it imported as much language as the government has done in this case, then yes, it would be enough, Your Honor.
Does it matter that a taking is not presumed to be unlawful, but killing is presumed to be unlawful?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's a meaningful distinction in that, as you had mentioned earlier, there is no lawful attempt or lawful premeditated killing. Again, the appellant has the ability to raise the defense of self-defense, but there is, as a default position, there is no lawful premeditated killing.
Well, wait a minute, counsel. I mean, that seems contrary to the appellant's position that the Army lawfully premeditatedly kills hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, in Iraq and Afghanistan, all that's premeditated killing, and it's all lawful. It's not self-defense. It's lawful killing.
Right? Yes, Your Honor.
By privileged belligerents.
And in those situations, Your Honor, those soldiers are using that lawful, lethal force lawfully because they've been ordered to do so.
And that's why the article says unlawfully kills as opposed to just kills.
Yes, Your Honor, but going back to this court's precedent in U.S. v. Bryant, it's not necessary for the government in court offenses to allege unlawfulness in order for that specification to be sufficient.
But you have to identify an offense under the code, and appellant says there's no offense under the code that says killing is a crime. It's more complicated than that.
Yes, Your Honor, but there is an offense under the code that says premeditated killing is a crime. And therefore, the appellant had sufficient notice in order to defend himself and protect himself against double jeopardy. Continuing on, Your Honor, to my second point, the specification mirrored the model specification of Article 80. And again, lastly, the specification provided the appellant with fair notice and protects him against double jeopardy. And turning to the elements of Article 80 itself, the appellant shot the victim's specialist CSG with a loaded firearm, therefore alleging an overt act. Specification alleged the act was done with specific intent to commit an offense under the code, as we've mentioned, by incorporating by reference Article 118 Alpha 1, specifically refers to an offense under the code. The specification alleged that the act was more than mere preparation. The appellant shot the victim's specialist CSG with a loaded firearm, hitting her with 3 hollow point bullets. And finally, the specification alleged the act apparently intended to affect the commission of the intended offense. The victim suffered grievous bodily harm because of appellant's shots with his 3 hollow point rounds, and in fact would have died had it not been for the first aid of her neighbor. The government alleged every element of Article 80, and thus this court should find that the specification stated an offense. Additionally, the specification exactly tracks the model specification of Article 80. It alleges facts providing personal jurisdiction, the date and location of the offense, and it describes the offense with sufficient detail to include expressly or by necessary implication every element. Finally, we turn to fair notice of the allegation and whether or not the specification protects him against double jeopardy. The government asserts that by charging the appellant with attempted to kill with premeditation, it provided the appellant with more notice than it had government merely charged the appellant with attempted murder. This is because by charging attempted to kill with premeditation, it specifically identified which of Article 118's 4 clauses the appellant was accused of violating. And as we mentioned earlier, this court can take a look at appellant's own actions in response to the specification, taking a look at his request to compel expert assistance, his first voir dire question, his failure to object to the judge's instructions on the elements of attempted premeditated murder. Finally, Your Honors, the specification protects the appellant against double jeopardy. It alleges specific facts, including date, place, victim, and the act. And additionally, this court has held that courts may examine the entire record of trial to determine whether or not someone's protected against double jeopardy. Pending any further questions, this court should affirm the service court's judgment.
Thank you, counsel. I'll have rebuttal.
Can I ask you a question? You've talked about the language of the specification and about how it's possible that he could have to construe this as somehow other than an unlawful act. What, if anything, do we make of the fact that it says that that the victim, that it was at or near Clarksville, Tennessee, and that the person he attempted to kill with premeditation was a specialist? I mean, doesn't that rule out any suggestion that this was an enemy combatant or in Iraq or someplace where you could kill with premeditation and have it in some sense or another be lawful or with justification or excuse?
Your Honor, I believe that Judge Olson's question answers that, and it takes looking beyond the facts of the specification to say, you know, the government suggests that it involved hollow point bullets and a .40 caliber weapon, and
I'm just looking at the language of the specification.
Okay. And my understanding is that Judge Olson's hypothetical answers that question.
Well, I'm asking you to answer the question.
I could, and an alternative example would be an active shooter incident, where like unfortunately we've had on posts where if the MPs arrived at the scene and attempted to kill whoever the active shooter was.
But wouldn't they have a justification or excuse then? So it would not be an unlawful killing, right? It wouldn't be a killing.
Your Honor, our position is that
it would be a killing, but they would have a justification or excuse.
Yes, they would. But that's why Congress placed unlawful in the statute is that the killing must.
So is your complaint that it doesn't say unlawful? Is your complaint that it doesn't say murder? What precisely is it that you?
If the government had wanted to plead it specifically, they would have said unlawfully kill with premeditation. I think it.
And then it would precisely track the statutory language of Article 118, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's what Norwood and Wong Tai say is not required for an inchoate offense.
No, but Norwood and Wong Tai do not upset the general rule that a specification nevertheless has to necessarily imply every element of the offense, which is why it makes sense to me that when you incorporate them either by reference to the statute itself, 1326 in Resendez-Ponce, or Articles 134 and 80, or actually they named them by title, adultery and obstruction, Your Honor. But they just didn't do that here. And it's asking this court to go beyond what the Supreme Court has done and what this court itself has done, to ask this court to stretch, to say this is close enough. And the phrase close enough here, it starts to backtrack, frankly, to the days of the Hydra, when this court had looked to any number of distinctions to try to determine whether or not something was an LIO or whether or not specification fairly implied every element of the offense. And Fossler has worked. I think that's the final point I'd like to make.
Well, this court, Fossler may be, I have a certain pride in Fossler.
Of course you do.
But Fossler deals with 134, and this ain't 134.
Chief,
Fossler also doesn't deal with an objection that was made after findings.
It doesn't. At the time, actually, with that particular rule, it said that the objection could be made at any point during the proceedings. Now, in Humphreys, again, this court carved that back and said we're going to follow the general rule that if it's not made prior to adjournment, that we are going to review for plain error. And the drafters amended the rule. And the president and the drafters could have amended their rule in any way they wanted on the heels of Humphreys, and they chose, for whatever the reason, the word adjournment. And it shouldn't be held against the defense counsel that they made the most out of an admittedly bad situation, a bad set of facts that they were dealt with, and they played by the rules. And we don't think it's gamesmanship. And if this court did want to amend its interpretation of the plain reading of those rules, we would ask the court, out of a sense of lenity, to do so after resolving this case on the otherwise plain language of the rules.
So in terms of the rule that refers to prior to adjournment, that talks about timeliness, but it doesn't address the standard that would be applied in determining whether it's meritorious.
It doesn't, but...
So it could still be timely, but could use the maximum liberality in the broad context in terms of the standard we would use.
This court certainly could. This court can do lots of things. But I would suggest that if I was a defense counsel in that case, sitting with a copy of Fossler and with a copy of Article 907B2E, that I would have felt ethically bound to do the same thing to maximize my client's chances at trial. I don't think it's gamesmanship. So pending further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Chief.
Court thanks counsel from both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess pending further order of the court. Thank you.